devastating wildfires to global migration, all around us there are signs of the grave impact that climate change is having on the way we live. And it comes with a heavy price tag for all involved. The day after Thanksgiving, as many Americans were busy with family and friends, the White House released a damning report about the impact climate change is predicted to have on our economy. Later this hour, we'll talk with a former Republican congressman about his party's agenda on the issue. And we check in on the recovery after the California wildfires, with a look at how homeowners are grappling with the insurance industry and the way the fires disrupted work for low-income workers. Another consequence of climate change, the global migration crisis. And while we mostly hear about Central American migrants fleeing violence and organized crime, another contributing factor is poor crop yields that are causing hunger and poverty. All of this is fueled by climate change. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. We begin the hour with the crisis on the southern border. What started as a peaceful march in Tijuana by migrants turned chaotic after some tried to cross the border into San Diego, California. But during those tense moments, U.S. Customs and Border Protection responded by firing tear gas on migrants, including women and children. Customs and Border Protection temporarily shut down the nearby San Ysidro Port of Entry, one of the busiest border crossings in the world. The Department of Defense, which has troops stationed along the U.S.-Mexico border, said they only help border officials move barricades. So far, dozens of migrants have been arrested. So let's talk about what happened. Maya Averbach is a freelance journalist who was at the border when this all happened. Maya, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Maya, what were the migrants demanding? I mean, was this a breakout group from the larger group of migrants, or were what were they protesting?
You know, the majority of migrants here have a faith and a hope that somehow there will be a resolution to their situation. And in the previous days, we've heard many people say that they wanted to have some sort of dialogue with the U.S., and they wanted to see if the U.S. would potentially open its doors to them. Many know that that is unlikely, and they know that it would definitely be difficult, but they don't have another option at this moment. Many of them have also put themselves on the list to request asylum, but see weeks-long waiting times. And so they were going towards the border in a rather orderly fashion in order to see what they could do, whether that means to see whether they could cross into the U.S. without trouble, which was definitely not the case as we saw yesterday, or whether to see if there was any official there who they could speak with. And they also did not succeed in that.
And give us a sense, you were there on the scene. What was the impact of the tear gas and the rubber bullets on the migrants?
They drove the migrants back. I think in some situations we did see migrants trying to cross over, but a few people, while many of the hundreds who were standing near the fence and again had gotten as far north as they could possibly get and were waiting to see what would happen. And they were pretty quickly repelled. People did circle back repeatedly, even after being tear gassed, again to try to see what else they could do. And there's a certain sense of desperation that has driven them to do that. But it was fairly strong, the tear gas, and so other people also had to leave the scene because of the impact of it.
What are the conditions for the migrants are experiencing right now, those who are in Tijuana who are waiting to present themselves at a port of entry?
Mm-hmm. So there are more than 5,000 people who are currently waiting in a sports center that has been designated by the government of Tijuana as a temporary shelter for the migrants. The majority of those people didn't go towards the border wall yesterday, just to be clear. It's a contingent of several hundred who started this peaceful march that and then ended up being fairly chaotic, while a lot of other people stayed behind. They're living in very cramped conditions. They're dependent on food handouts that sometimes run short. The line, in particular for men, is incredibly long. People are sleeping outdoors, which means there's a high level of illness. And with all of those conditions, which are deteriorating pretty quickly now that they've been there for more than 10 days, people don't have a very clear sense of whether they qualify for asylum, what the asylum process is. And when they've put themselves on this strange and informal list that is maintained by asylum seekers at the border because the U.S. only lets a few people in each day at the San Ysidro port of entry here, they've been told that it's going to take weeks. Some have heard it may take months. And they're in a standoff because they don't believe that they can live in these camp conditions for that period of time. And the government of Tijuana has said it also can't maintain them for that period of time.
Maya, you've also mentioned the fact that the San Ysidro, which is the port of entry that was shut down yesterday, albeit temporarily. I'm wondering, you being there on the ground, are you feeling or are you seeing that this is an actual crisis? Or is this some sort of a manufactured crisis, if you will, with the closing of the port of entry, the sending of troops down to the border? Like, what's really happening here?
Well, we just have to understand the scale. There are hundreds of thousands of people who come to the U.S. border each year. And there are thousands of people who seek asylum each year in an orderly fashion. I think that one possible response we might have seen is an increase in processing capacity at the border, but that's not what the U.S. government opted for. Instead, we've seen this militarized response, which is done in response to also a group that is significant in numbers, but fairly small in comparison to all of the people who come to the border each year and are asylum seekers. And so in some ways, I think that the headlines misconstrue the scale. We're talking about what the the Mexican government said yesterday was 500 people coming towards the border and a very swift militarized response to that.
Maya Averbach is a freelance journalist who's been following the migrant caravan for The New York Times. Maya, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The clashes at the border took place just one day after the Washington Post reported on a tentative deal between the Trump administration and the incoming Mexican government on how to handle the flow of migrants. The plan, called Remain in Mexico, would require asylum seekers to stay in Mexico while they wait for their cases to move forward in U.S. courts. That process can take months or sometimes even years. The incoming Mexican administration later denied that any deal had been made. Mexico's president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador will be sworn in on Sunday. And all of this comes just a few days after a federal judge blocked the Trump administration's attempt to only accept asylum claims from people presenting themselves at ports of entry. Joining us now to discuss all of this is Dara Lynn, senior correspondent with Vox covering immigration. Dara, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Lots to unpack here in a couple minutes. Let's start about what we know. The incoming Mexican government is sort of distancing itself now from this Remain in Mexico plan. How close were these two, how close were we and the incoming government to making a deal?
It's not really clear. The reporting that we have indicates that there was kind of an agreement in principle to the Mexican government, or the incoming Mexican government was okay with allowing Central American asylum seekers to stay in Mexico while their asylum claims were pending. But there were a lot of details to be worked out, including how they could actually guarantee the safety of those asylum seekers, which would be kind of important under U.S. law, which prohibits the U.S. from returning people to someplace where they would be in danger. So it's not clear whether they were very, very close to a deal and kind of just needed to fill in the gaps, or whether this was something that was really going to take a lot more hard discussion. Of course, the events of the last 24 hours in Tijuana have also kind of thrown up in the air even what's been agreed to so far. It's not really clear whether when the new Mexican government comes in on December 1st, whether this is going to be as high a priority for them as it might have been when this was first reported on Saturday.
And the other question I have is what is the benefit? Like, what's the incentive for the incoming Mexican government to agree to work with the Trump administration on this?
There are a few possibilities here. The one that the Mexican government appears to have articulated is that they already kind of have to deal with Central American asylum seekers. As Maya was saying, people are currently waiting for weeks or months in Tijuana, to a certain extent in Ciudad Juarez and other cities along the border. So having some kind of formal agreement could actually help the Mexican government provide a support structure. The other possibility here is that while López Obrador was elected as, you know, something of a left populist, he's never had quite as strong opinions on migration issues as he has on some other things. And so in a relationship with the U.S. that, you know, is going to include a lot of issues that López Obrador does feel strongly about, including, you know, trade and economic support, this could be an easy way to win some brownie points with the Trump administration, which cares a lot more about migration than it does about other things.
And I'm also wondering if you give us a sense of what the Mexican government, in terms of its own policy of deportations. We know that the Mexican National Institute of Migration has already reported 11,000 Central American migrants have been deported from Mexico since October 19th. Of those, about 2,000 were from the caravans.
Right. The Mexican government has been serving as the U.S.'s kind of auxiliary force in interceding and deporting Central American migrants for the last several years. This is just kind of a stepped up version of that. However, a lot of those deportations have been happening in southern Mexico. People are intercepted while they are kind of en route rather than once they've gotten to the U.S.-Mexico border. So people who are already there, who are waiting to seek asylum in the U.S., the risk is absolutely still there that they're going to get deported and sent all the way back. But it's a somewhat different situation than Mexico building up its own southern border in an attempt to catch people as they come in.
And do you think the incoming administration may have walked things back, given the images that came out of women and children being assaulted by tear gas and rubber bullets?
Well, the Mexican government has been working with the U.S. government on trying to prevent people from crossing the Mexico-U.S. border. The Mexican federal police helped shut down the San Ysidro port of entry yesterday, and they were pushing people back away from the border in concert with the U.S. shooting tear gas over. So really what's been happening isn't so much a U.S.-Mexico conflict at the border as it is both governments trying to prevent people from crossing the border between them.
Dara Lind is a senior correspondent with Vox covering immigration. Dara, thanks again.
Thank you.
Last month, the United Nations Scientific Panel on Climate Change issued a shocking report warning that the planet could start to see catastrophic consequences of global warming by as early as 2040. The Trump administration downplayed the report. But on Friday, the White House released its own report, published by 13 federal agencies. That report predicted vast economic devastation from climate change, including an increase in natural disasters, a decline in domestic agricultural production, and a decrease to the U.S. GDP by as much as 10% by the year 2100. That would be double the Great Recession. Top Republicans have expressed skepticism about the report's findings. But where does the Republican Party under President Trump stand on tackling climate change? Bob Inglis represented South Carolina in Congress until 2010, and today he runs a nonprofit called RepublicEN.org devoted to changing his party's stance on climate change. Congressman Inglis, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
So you describe yourself as a climate skeptic initially and are now trying to turn things around?
That's right. For 6 years in Congress, my first 6 years, I said climate change was nonsense. I didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it. And since I represented such a red district in a red state, that was the end of the inquiry. But then as Al 6 years, came back for another six, and in that second six, realized that it was a serious challenge and one that we can fix.
And so what was the impetus that made you realize that this is, in fact, something that needs to be addressed, climate change, that is?
Well, first step was my son coming to me when he was voting for the first time when I ran again in 04. He just turned 18. So he said to me, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." His four sisters agreed. His mother agreed. New constituency, you know. And so that was step one. Step two was going to Antarctica with the Science Committee and seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. Step three in this metamorphosis was another Science Committee trip. and being inspired by the faith of an Aussie climate scientist who showed me what it's about loving God and loving people to address climate change. So as a result of all that, I switched around and said, climate change is real. Let's do something about it.
Why your party, or the Republican Party, should I say, has been quite resistant, at least at some of the highest levels, to acknowledging that this is an issue and to doing much about it. We are starting to hear some change from younger conservatives and younger Republicans who do say this is important for them. But what do you think is the, is it purely politics right now that's holding both this party back from really making change, Bob?
Well, I think that it's a lot of solution aversion. There's a sense that we don't have a solution that fits with our conservative values, because the conversation so far has been conducted in the language of the left, really. And so what we do at RepublicEN.org is help conservatives to hear it in the language of conservatism, with people like Milton Friedman telling us, what do you do about pollution? Well, you tax it, of course. And basically helping folks to see the opportunity as well as the risk, because free enterprise can solve this if we simply fix the economics. And when conservatives hear that, then they can engage.
Now, did you have a chance to look at this report that was issued by the White House kind of under the radar on a long holiday weekend on a Friday? I mean, it's one of the, you know, it's pretty obvious times to issue something you're not interested in getting a lot of eyeballs on. Have you had a chance to see it? And if so, do you agree with the severity of its conclusions, particularly the economic ones?
Yes and yes. You know, it's very... This is consistent with what we've been hearing. It's just that what these reports continue to do is shed more light on the path ahead. And it's not the far away path. It's the very near path. It's within the lifetimes of the people that of you and me, you know, certainly within the lifetimes of babies being born today. But it's within the lifetime of somebody like me that's going to see these impacts. And so that's what the report does. It helps us to see more and more clearly what's coming our way.
And of course, you know, the science is increasingly clearer and clearer for folks on both sides of the political divide. But the president, President Trump, continued to deny climate change. He tweeted over the holiday weekend about this, and he's essentially rolled back a lot of environmental regulations. Over the weekend, he was referring in his tweet to the cold weather that some of us in the Northeast were experiencing and said, whatever happened to global warming? My question is, how much of a role is the president playing in this unwillingness to tackle the problem head on, at least from the Republican Party?
I think it's significant, of course, is the role that the president is playing. But I think that in a strange sort of way, he may help us, because when he leaves office, he's going to take climate disputation with him. It's going to be so closely identified with him, this really silliness of making an equivalency between weather and climate, that people are going to wake up and say, you know, that was really pretty silly. And there he goes off the stage. Let him take climate disputation with him. And now let's the adults in the room and the Americans who believe in solutions get with it and lead the world to a solution. So I think he's becoming quite a caricature of the silliness of climate disputation. And sure, he plays to his crowd and sends out silly tweets. But meanwhile, his scientists, the people within the administration, contracted by the administration to help advise, are saying the bridge is out. But Trump is at the foot of the bridge saying full speed ahead. Now, how does that person get viewed over time? I think they get viewed as somebody that wasn't helping us, telling us to full speed ahead when the bridge is out ahead.
Congressman, you were on the show about a year ago, and I'm wondering, since then, have you seen any change?
We've seen a big change. You know, Great Recession, everybody's focused on the immediate. Now the economy's better. We've had more experiences with climate change. And there's a growing eco-right in America that can help us find free enterprise solutions. So I think it's quite a different situation than we've been in. And there's a lot of hope for an answer coming soon.
Bob Inglis is a former congressman from South Carolina and the executive director of the nonprofit group Republic EN. MyGrantsHelps.org. Congressman Inglis, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Just days before Thanksgiving, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a wide-ranging warning about romaine lettuce. Don't eat it, no matter where you got it from, and if you have some in the fridge, just throw it away. The reason? Another E. coli outbreak, with dozens of reported cases across 11 states and Canada, all of them linked to the ubiquitous leafy green. And unlike previous E. coli outbreaks, the CDC doesn't yet know where this one might have started. But one thing we do know is that farmers aren't required to test their irrigation water for things like E. coli. And though growers were supposed to start testing their irrigation water this year, the Trump administration delayed the rule for at least another 4 years. Here to help us understand all this is Elizabeth Shogren, science reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
And Susie Nielsen is a freelance journalist who reports on the intersection of science and politics. Susie, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Elizabeth, let's start with you. We've seen similar E. coli breaks. This isn't the first one we've heard about. How has the government tried to address these recurring threats, if they have at all?
Well, actually, the government has been doing a really exhaustive investigation to try to figure out why last spring there was a big outbreak in lettuce at that time was from Yuma, Arizona, also romaine lettuce. And the reason that they did the big investigation was that five people died last spring from eating lettuce, which is supposed to be good for you, right? And they did a big investigation, and they were not able to figure it out. They did find the strain of E. coli in an irrigation canal, the same strain that was making people so sick, hundreds of people sick, and as I said, five people died. But they didn't find how did that get from the irrigation canal to the lettuce that people actually ate at a restaurant or bought at a store.
And I mentioned a little bit about this in the introduction to this segment, that there have been multiple outbreaks in E. coli and in our food system. What's that gap that keeps allowing this to happen, Elizabeth?
Well, what we learned is that the federal government had a plan to require farmers, all kinds of farmers across the country, anybody who makes produce that we eat raw, to start testing their water to make sure that the water that they use to irrigate and to mix chemicals is not tainted with some kind of pathogen like E. coli that comes from the guts of animals and can make us really sick or kill us. So the government had never required testing in this. They require testing to see whether our beaches are clean, whether our drinking water is clean. But the federal government doesn't require testing of any kind with irrigation water. Farmers can just take it from whatever source they have nearby. They can take it from the stream running past that could be downstream of a bunch of cows that could be spreading this E. coli disease. It's something that actually was very surprising to me. I didn't realize that the water that they spray on vegetables and fruit that we might eat has not been tested to know if it's clean or not. And then what happened was that in 2006, there was a huge outbreak in spinach, and Congress decided that this can't go on anymore. There was a big law passed, the Food Safety Modernization Act, and they decided that farmers have to start testing. But it took them forever to pass the rules to require this testing. They finally passed it, and it was supposed to start kicking in earlier this year. And instead, the Trump administration delayed these rules for a long time.
Susie, what are the farmers saying about these outbreaks? How have they responded to whether it's the spinach outbreak, the romaine outbreak, and beyond?
I actually visited a farm for this article a couple of months ago, and I spoke with several food safety inspectors and folks that are doing the water testing on the ground, because many farms actually voluntarily test their water. And some of these food safety inspectors say that despite the fact that they're doing this testing, produce outbreaks will occur just because it's so difficult to detect these pathogens in water, because the tests actually just test for the presence of bacteria. So the more bacteria, the more of an alarm that goes off, but they can't detect the most harmful strains. They can't single those out, basically. So what farmers are saying, to me anyway, first of all, is that these outbreaks aren't entirely preventable, even with the current testing that the FDA would have implemented. And secondly, that the regulations that the FDA would implement would be so expensive for small farmers that it would put some of them out of business. I spoke with an apple farmer in Washington who said, you know, first of all of his water comes from the Cascade Mountains, so it's very clean and unlikely to get tainted. And second of all, it would cost him $4,000 in startup costs, which to him is really burdensome because he's a small farmer.
But what are some of those expensive or cost prohibited solutions that they would be concerned about? You mentioned $4,000 irrigation system. Are there other things that smaller farmers would be worried about?
Oh, just things like buying a computer that would enable somebody to keep a bunch of data on. One thing that Elizabeth and I found was that, you know, farmers aren't collecting data in big amounts and sharing them with the government, which would have made it easier for people to trace the outbreak back to its source. And a lot of farmers, I mean, one of the farmers I spoke with said he didn't even have a computer that would host some of this data. So, you know, elementary things like that, or, you know, just regular monthly testing requires somebody to go to all of your sources of water and test them regularly. That can mean something like hiring someone part-time, which many farmers would have a hard time doing.
What about, Susie, but what about any government subsidies or something that could be tucked into the farm bill that would help these smaller farmers and, by extension, save lives?
That's a really, really good question. And one thing that Elizabeth and I found that we found particularly shocking is that these delays will save the farm industry overall, according to the FDA's own financial analysis. It'll save them about $12 million a year, but it's going to cost the public $108 million a year in healthcare costs and associated costs. So when the costs to the public are that high and the cost to industry so low, you have to ask, why isn't the government stepping in and providing, you know, pretty small subsidies to help the public avoid these kinds of encounters?
Elizabeth, what are lawmakers trying to do about this? I mean, we mentioned that the Trump administration has delayed a decision on this for another couple of years. The Trump administration has also made deregulation a centerpiece of the administration's agenda. So what is there anyone out there who's trying to solve this problem outside of that?
You know, one thing that has surprised me, I do cover many kinds of regulations in Washington, and I've covered them for a long time. And there are, of course, public interest groups that are trying to get attention to this issue. But I've been surprised by how little attention it's been getting from Congress, despite these outbreaks, including deadly outbreaks. Although once there was this deadly outbreak of romaine, then some of the scientists I talked to and some public interest groups we talked to, they said, you know, look, the government needs to do something now to start testing. The government did after they came out with their report of what happened in the spring and why, which basically includes so many questions that they have failed to answer yet. When they came out with their report, they said that we will start a new system of testing the lettuce before people buy it. They haven't provided an update yet of how that's going because this announcement, or even if they've started, this announcement only came out early this month. So I think that Susie and I were both really shocked that there wasn't more of a sense of urgency to do something about this in the meantime. Instead, you know, as Susie just said, we're just willing to put up with $100 million worth of hospital bills, of people getting sick because the government's failing to follow through with its own plan to try to make people safer.
Elizabeth Shogren is a science reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Susie Nielsen is a freelance journalist who reports on the intersection of science and politics. Susie, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can, too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
We go to Southern California now, where residents evacuated from the Woolsey Fire have slowly been returning home. Three people died in the fire and more than 1,600 buildings were destroyed. The Woolsey Fire mostly impacted the affluent area of Malibu. And a tragedy like this affects everyone from homeowners to the service industry workers and day laborers. Emily Elena Dugdale is a reporter for KPCC and LAist, and she's been following what happens to those day laborers and domestic workers when tragedy upends the work they depend on.
There are probably hundreds of day laborers in the area, and they are keeping the city running. You know, they are doing construction jobs, they are washing windows, cars, they're cooking, tending lawns, and then a lot of them work on the ranches and fields there. If you know Malibu, it's kind of constructed in a series of canyons, and there's a lot of large houses, a lot of ranch houses there. So these people are really doing every job you can conceive of in this city.
And when we think about who they are, is there a demographic profile of many of the laborers?
They're largely going to be Spanish-speaking and Latino workers, and that's pretty common in the Los Angeles area.
So one of the things that we were curious about, and I know you'd written about this, is what effect these fires, especially the Woolsey Fire, had on these workers.
You know, we've talked a lot in the media about kind of who's been affected by the Woolsey fires. And, you know, it's important to remember that, you know, several dozen homes, you know, were burned in Malibu. Thousands of people were displaced. So talking about the laborers, you know, it doesn't take away from, you know, detract from the real hardships and issues that that community has faced. At the same time, when a house is burned down, when you can't get to work, these people who are coming in, these day laborers and service workers, they're also losing out. They're also losing employment. Sometimes they are losing their living place. And in the case of Malibu, the city was actually shut down for a week. It has slowly been reopening over the past week or so, and there are still places that you can't access. So, you know, these people who oftentimes will commute a very far way to get to work, you know, several hours, several buses, are now without a job. And again, in some cases, without a home.
And so you visited with some of the workers. Are they able to receive any services from the federal government?
Right. So many of these workers are undocumented, and so they do not qualify for federal relief programs if they lose their job or their home as a result of disaster. And it's important to remember that even if they do qualify for this, a lot of these folks, you know, they have a fear of law enforcement. They might have family members who are undocumented. They don't want to draw attention to that. They might have limited English proficiency. All of those things might also keep them from turning from those programs.
What about their employers on average? Are the folks that live in these beautiful homes in Malibu, are they able to step up and help these folks out?
So, you know, in theory, yes, they are. And actually, I have talked to at least one gentleman whose parents did employ day workers, and they were getting some sort of subsidy during the time that Malibu was kind of shut down and they weren't able to go to work. So it is definitely possible. The folks that I talked to, that wasn't really the case for them. You know, they weren't getting any type of aid from the people that employed them.
And what is their plan on the people that you talk to? Are they planning to wait it out and see if their employers will hire them back? Or are they looking for employment elsewhere?
Well, I think that's the interesting part is when I talked to these folks, you know, they were either on the bus trying to get into the city, even though it was really shut down, or they were coming back day to day to Malibu to try to figure out how to work. And, you know, they kind of just told me, like, you know, oh, we're just going to keep trying. You know, some of them are making pretty good money here. The man I talked to, Julio Osorio, in my article, he could bring home about, you know, up to $120 a day from, you know, finding a job that lasts 8 hours or so. So this is pretty good money. And so it's, you'd be hard pressed to turn away from that.
Emily Elena Dugdale is a reporter with LAist and KPCC. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The midterm elections aren't over yet. A couple of House races are still up in the air. And in Mississippi, a runoff between Mississippi Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith and Democrat Mike Espy is set for Tuesday. Back in 1986, Espy became the first Black Mississippi congressman since Reconstruction. A win tomorrow would make him the first Black senator from the state since that period. Hyde-Smith is feeling the heat as she walked back racist comments earlier this month that made light of public hangings and also joked about voter suppression. She defended the comments in a debate last week.
This comment was twisted, and it was turned into a weapon to be used against me, a political weapon used for nothing but personal and political gain by my opponent. That's the type of politics Mississippians are sick and tired of.
Desiree Frazier has been covering the race for Mississippi Public Broadcasting in Jackson. Desiree, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
The big challenge here seems to be really Espy's chances of winning. A lot of folks are saying it's going to be a pretty big long shot. In fact, the polling website 538 has his chances at 25%. I'm just shocked at how low that is given Hyde-Smith's comments.
Well, Mississippi is a very Republican, conservative state, and people here, by and large, vote according to race. That has been the case over the years. The population is probably 65% white, around 35% Black. And so you see the party breakdown that way. Democrats, approximately 35%. Republicans, 65%. So the Republican base is probably going to support her. The question is, will moderate Republicans who feel that her remarks have damaged the state and who are concerned about how the rest of the world perceives Mississippi, which has been an issue over the years because of its violent racist past, will they still vote for Cindy Hyde-Smith or will they vote for Mike Espy? And in speaking with Mike Espy's campaign spokesperson, he told me yesterday that they have been courting all people, all Mississippians. And in that, he says that they have talked to white voters who say that they are not voting based on party, but on the person, and that they're supporting Espy.
And that's because of these comments that she made. Again, she said that she would attend a, quote unquote, public hanging. These are comments that are deeply offensive, given, as you mentioned, the history of Mississippi and also where we are today. I mean, members of the Jackson City Council casted a symbolic no confidence vote and asked the governor to remove her from office. I want to play some audio where you hear city leaders expressing their outrage over the comment.
It is hate. It is racism. And it exists, and we have to do something about it.
What's been the public reaction?
Well, it has been a concern about these remarks. There has been outrage, as you just heard. And that is part of the issue. As concerning as the public hanging statement is, after that, she was recorded talking about voter suppression of liberal votes, and her campaign said she was joking. She was talking to students, and that was concerning for some. And then she was also shown in a photo at a museum in Mississippi, the Jefferson Davis Museum. He was Confederate president, holding a rifle and wearing a Confederate hat. And her remark was Mississippi history at its best. So I think the culmination of these things are concerning. And the Espy camp is saying this is taking Mississippi back, not forward. But I will also add, at issue are the issues. For instance, the tax cuts, the trade war. Mississippi is an agricultural state. Soybean farmers are hurting. And so this is a concern for the Espy camp, and this is what they're campaigning about, the issues that are impacting Mississippians as a whole, not just the remarks she made.
Desiree Frazier is a reporter for Mississippi Public Broadcasting in Jackson, Mississippi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for spending your Monday with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.